Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you. Hosted by your local Labor MPs.
Kia ora koutou, ko Julie Ferry, tuku ingoa, ko maunga oika, te maunga, ko wairo te awa, ko waitemata te whanga. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Kia ora, my name is Julie Ferry. I'm one of five Roskill Community Voice reps on the Pukitāpapa Local Board of Auckland Council. I'm part of the City Vision Centre-Left whānau and I have a monthly spot here on Red Alert Radio. Very keen to get your feedback. You can find me very easily on social media because I have a strange last name. If you have a look on Twitter and Facebook and search for Julie Ferry, that's spelled F for Fred, A-I-R-E-Y. We also have a Red Alert Radio Facebook page, and if you search for Red Alert Radio AKL, you should find us pretty easily. We put up links to these shows as podcasts once they're up online, as well as other bits of useful news relevant to the topics we cover. You can also get all our past shows on the Red Alert Radio archive on planetaudio.org.nz, and they go back all the way to 2008 with some pretty famous previous hosts, including the current mayor. So well worth having a little look around there and a bit of a listen. Now today I'm revisiting a past topic, talking again with Olivia Paulson, who is one of the conveners of Mums for Refugees. Now Olivia is a lawyer in her day job and she moved back to Auckland from Australia where she first got involved in refugee issues. We did an episode with Olivia back in May, around the time that many people all over the world were becoming aware of how the USA government was treating those seeking asylum at the Mexican border, in particular separating children from their families and putting them in camps. The main issue we talked about then is how the situation for those seeking asylum in Australia was unfortunately not any better than those on the Mexican border, and in some ways worse. Now we're talking about this again in October because since then the Pacific Islands Forum has happened in Nauru, where Australia imprisons many of the refugees, and New Zealand has finally agreed to increase our own refugee quota to 1,500. I'm hoping to explore with Olivia what, if anything, has changed for those on Nauru and Manus Island, or at the threat of ending up there, and whether there are new avenues to pressure the Australian government and others to do the right thing and change their inhumane policy. Thanks for being on the show today, Olivia.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first up, just a little bit of an introduction to Mums for Refugees for those who are new to your organisation. How does it start? What does it do?
So Mums for Refugees is a network of mothers from across Australia and New Zealand who've joined together because we care about and want to support and advocate for better and more humane policies and treatment of refugees and asylum seekers. It started in Sydney, but we now have groups across Australia and in New Zealand. We've been in New Zealand since about the beginning of this year.
Yep.
And sort of gradually growing and finding our feet and getting our groove. So.
And so one of the things that Mums for Refugees did earlier this year, which I was a bit involved with too, was to organise some protests at US consulates and embassies.
Yes, very involved, I think. But yeah. That's right. That was around the time that all the border separations were happening in the US and Mexico, and we organised with some other groups, Amnesty and Wage Peace, these protests at their consulates in Wellington and in Auckland, and that was primarily focused on what was happening in the US, but also we tried to use that as an opportunity to raise and as a platform to build awareness about the fact that the same thing is happening in our region, and that, you know, there are families and children detained on Nauru and men on Manus who've been, you know, in indefinite detention in pretty horrific conditions for 5 years now.
And so that's what we're going to focus on today. We talked a lot last time about, and I think this is one of the things that to me is quite stark, the Australian attitude to refugees and asylum seekers. From this side of the Tasman, we look at it and we think, gosh, that's really harsh. But actually, we only take 1,500. Well, we're about to get ready to take 1,500 refugees. What do you think, have you noticed any improvements in terms of the attitudes, either in Australia or here, to refugees and asylum seekers? Australia has yet another, dare I say, new Prime Minister. Daylight savings, time for Australia to change the Prime Minister, they say. Although, you know, he's not of a different political stripe than the previous two. New Zealand's new Prime Minister is starting to hit her stripes on the international stage. Do you think either of those things are making an impact?
I think the Australian Prime Minister, I think what we have to remember about Scott Morrison is that he's one of the great architects of offshore processing. He has held the immigration portfolio. He held it just after, maybe when the camps were reopened. He was immigration minister when the riots on Manus happened. He was immigration minister when Reza Barati died on Manus. So he is certainly not seen as, you know, a great white hope for a change for them. And actually, the mood of people in those offshore camps when they found out that he was going to be the new prime minister was pretty despairing. They are rightly terrified of and scared by the influence he could have on Australian policy. New Zealand, I mean, Jacinda is doing a wonderful job of promoting our image. You know, I think she's becoming that, you know, you see all that UN stuff with her there with her baby and this beacon of hope and this more compassionate and kinder attitude that, you know, she very much projects, I think, on behalf of New Zealand. But in terms of actual change, it's great to see the quota increase to 1,500, but, I mean, even that was a bit of a circus to get across the line with, you know, yeah. Winston saying, oh, it's not done. And look, in the region, she's still, you know, we're only New Zealand. You know, she's very much hamstrung by what she can do, particularly around the stuff on Manus and Nauru. I mean, she's been saying for a long time, since before she was Prime Minister, that she would support New Zealand taking people off these islands. But when the Australians don't want to happen and when the Nauruans don't want it to happen, there's really only so far, you know, she can push it. And I think she feels now that she has done what she can do. And we kind of saw that in her attitude at the Pacific Island Forum, I think.
Okay. We'll come back to that a bit. Just before we go off the Australian leadership issue, because here the perception from those of us who follow Australian politics sort of on the surface was that Peter Dutton was the sort of, you know, when he was possibly going to be Prime Minister for 5 minutes there.
Oh, that was pretty terrifying.
Yeah. And so that's interesting to me that Scott Morrison is potentially as bad on these issues as Peter Dutton, but he looks more moderate, perhaps because...
I think that's right.
Yeah, yeah, Peter Dutton comes across as being sort of more cruel, I guess.
And he's... And, you know, it's the basic... He's personable and he's charming and he kind of talks the talk to mainstream. In fact, a lot of people I talked to around the time all that was happening actually said, look, Dutton, in terms of his policies, is super hardline and that is terrifying. But Morrison in some ways is more terrifying because many people don't think Dutton could have won the next Australian election, whereas they feel that Morrison could.
So, like, Morrison's more effective.
More effective and just more liked.
Yeah, yeah. So...
People who aren't as in touch with these issues are more likely to vote for him, I think.
Yeah. I think certainly more personable, although some of the stuff that he's saying about broader human rights issues, like around homosexuality and stuff, is starting to take the shine off a bit. I guess we'll see. So you mentioned the Pacific Island Forum. So last time we talked, there was some hope that there might be a bit of a, not necessarily a breakthrough, but there might be able to be some progress made through the forum, particularly given it was being held on Nauru. So was there anything that did happen at the forum that gave you hope, or conversely that went against making some progress?
The forum was interesting. I think the forum itself in terms of these issues was a bit of a fizzle.
Yeah.
It did draw, which I think probably realistically was the main thing we hoped for, it drew attention to Nauru. It made people aware of what it's like. It spotlighted some of the issues around things like media access.
Yeah.
So the ABC journalists who wanted to travel to Nauru to the forum were all refused visas by the Nauruan government.
Right.
And a New Zealand...
That was Barbara Drever, wasn't it?
Barbara Drever, a New Zealand journalist, was detained, not arrested, but detained by the Nauruan police when she tried to meet with and interview a refugee family.
And so, and I mean, she's got a huge history and huge mana in the Pacific region for as a journalist.
Absolutely. She's been the TVNZ Pacific correspondent for quite a long time. And, you know, personal view. She's a great journalist. She's thorough, and I think, and she's sensible. She's, you know, and I think to see someone like her being detained for trying to do this stuff, if nothing else, I think perhaps it made New Zealanders aware that there is something going on here that we should be concerned about. And, you know, it's very hard for the... And the Nauruans toe the line. They say all the time, oh, these journalists are really activists. These doctors are really activists. We're doing a fine job. Everything's great here. But when you persistently see journalists being refused entry, journalists arrested, doctors refused entry, I think even the more cynical among us have to say, look, there's obviously something going on here that we need to be deeply concerned about.
I think, I mean, I remember when Barbara Drever, I think it was Barbara Drever, it might have been Michael Field, were blocked from going into Fiji and detained in Fiji.
Yeah, I think it was during, Barbara.
Yeah, probably both of them at some point. And it just seems to me that if your government, I'm talking about Nauru here, is not letting journalists do their jobs... Mm. Then that's a really big red flag in terms
of... At a major international forum.
Yeah, what is happening that they don't want people to see?
Yeah.
And I guess what they don't want people to see is what's happening in those camps.
Yeah, that's right. And there were all sorts of conditions put on the journalists who did get visas, prohibiting them from talking to or meeting with refugees or asylum seekers. They weren't allowed into the camps. In the weeks leading up to the forum, one of the tent camps was demolished. It was very much,
So what, I mean, I guess just to sort of bring that home a little bit to listeners, I mean, we have the Māngere Centre here where refugees are processed through before they go out to wherever they're going to live in New Zealand. Yep. What would it, you know, do media have access to that? Is that, you know, is that comparable? I mean, obviously it's... Yeah, I would hope it's not as inhumane.
Well, the Māngere Centre is, I think, a great... I mean, it's a very small facility because we only take, you know, 750 increasing to 1,500 a year. But it's a great facility. It's, you know, people go in there when they first arrive in New Zealand. They're fed, they get classes, the children go to school, there's psychiatric care, there's medical care. It's a proper resourced facility, staffed and volunteered, and... aimed at preparing people for a life in New Zealand. These are tent camps with very rudimentary, you know, I mean, tents without aircon and, you know...
In the tropical
climate on, you know, ground that's all phosphate rock because Nauru for many years was a phosphate mine.
Yep.
You know, limited medical facilities. I don't think you can even compare... I mean, I don't think you can even compare the Australian onshore detention centres to our... refugee centre in Māngere. They are much more comparable to our prisons than to our resettlement centre here.
So if journalists in New Zealand were blocked from accessing our prisons, blocked from accessing the Māngere Centre, I mean, obviously there are some sensible restrictions around access, particularly to prison, but, you know, to just blanket say, you can't see it, don't try and fly any drones anywhere near it, talking to anybody off-site who's involved with any of those organisations that are working on-site.
Yeah. People who are there aren't allowed visitors, you know.
Yeah.
It's very difficult for Australians and New Zealanders generally to get a visa to go to Nauru, even you or I, and very expensive. I think the visa application fee is several thousand dollars.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, they really don't want us to go there. Okay, so since the Pacific Island Forum, and my perception was too that it was, as you said, a bit of a fizzer in terms of not necessarily much progress was made. In the last week, the Nauru government has forced, and I might say this terribly, mangle this French terribly, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, they've forced them off the island. And my understanding is they were the main provider of medical care.
Particularly medical mental health care, yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that seems to me just a huge step. That's the equivalent to saying to the Red Cross, you can't work in a disaster zone.
Yeah, I think that's right. It is. It's very concerning that a group like that is being denied access to provide medical care to a community that it's becoming increasingly obvious is under huge pressure and has huge mental health issues. I mean, you know, when you have an environment where we're hearing not intermittent, regular reports of children as young as 9 talking about killing themselves, attempting to kill themselves. Mm. When you're hearing now reports of some of these children having what they call resignation syndrome, where they, you know, they don't talk, they don't get out of bed, they barely eat. This is, you know, kids giving up on life.
Yeah.
And you then, and the government's response to that is to say, oh, this is all, and I think it's sort of, this is all hysteria, they're just trying to get out of here, it's all made up, so we'll just get rid of all the doctors because they are not taking our side. They're, you know, giving credibility to it. So we'll ban them. The other thing that we've heard in the last week, which is incredibly concerning, is that the Nauruan government has indicated that it will arrest the parents of some of these children with severe mental health issues for neglect.
So, hang on. So, people are in a camp with their kids, having fled from persecution and
been on incredibly traumatic boat journeys.
Yep.
And they've been there now, a lot of them, for 5 years.
In the tropical heat with no air conditioning.
And no proper medical care and no future. And very limited education, because the school, there was initially a Red Cross run school for the camp that was closed.
Right.
There is a school on Nauru for the refugee children and local children, but most of the refugee kids don't go. Their parents are worried about their safety. There's lots of reports of bullying.
Yeah. So if a parent is already in detention in the camp, what does arresting look like?
Taking them to Nauru prison. Well, most of the parents, to be clear, most of the parents now are not detained in the camp. Most families now have had their refugee status determined.
Right.
And they are living, they say living in the community, but they're living in camps that have been created for them to live in, or some of them in prefabricated housing or housing within the community. So they can move around within the island.
Right.
But you have to remember that Nauru is the size of Rangitoto.
Okay.
So it's not, and there's very limited facilities. Some of them work.
Yeah.
There's, so,
and they can't go anywhere else?
No, they can't leave, yeah.
So it's just a prison without walls, really, isn't it?
Yes.
And so for a child's parents to be arrested, that means the parent goes to prison.
Yeah.
So who looks after the child?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess that, yeah, it's not clear. That's not something the police have thought about, I think. We have had stories there where parents have been put in prison on Nauru previously, and the kids have ended up with other families.
But that adds
there
stress
are some
to those
stuff
families.
There, but they, and I just think, you know, as a parent, you know, we're both mothers. Can you imagine anything worse than trying desperately to help and support a child with mental health issues? You know, you do everything you can for your kids, right? These parents terrified, desperately worried. When I was in Australia, did some volunteer pro bono work and acted on one of the early cases of one of the kids who was transferred to Australia for severe mental health issues. You know, I remember talking to his mother and she said, I haven't slept for 4 days because I'm scared of what he'll do if I'm not paying attention. You know, parents are already in that environment. And then to be accused of neglect and blamed for your child, those issues, and threatened with prison, it's just...
And to be separated from them when you can't do anything to help.
And you're terrified they're going to hurt themselves.
Yeah, and if the camps are that bad, then prison must be pretty horrific too.
It's a very basic prison.
Yeah, in terms of your own mental health too, and physical health. So the UN's refugee agency has also called for, so UNHCR has also called for all of the 1,400 refugees and asylum seekers to be evacuated from there and from Manus Island.
Mm-hmm.
So, what are the chances of that actually happening? This is one of the things I struggle with is I understand that New Zealand has said to the Australian government, look, we'll take at least some of these people. And Australia has said, no, we're talking to Donald Trump, we're talking to the US, that's our priority, is sorting that deal. Now, that deal goes back to when Obama was president.
Yep.
So they've been not resolving this deal for over 2 years, coming up 2 years in November.
Mm.
So
There has been people who have gone to the US under that deal.
Great.
Not a huge number, though, and it does seem to be slowing, from what I understand, slowing down. I think one of the issues, too, is an awful lot of the people who are still on these islands are from countries that the US now has travel bans in respect
of.
So,
and I suppose some of them will be Muslim, which, even if they're not from a country with a travel ban, will be at least slowing the process down for them.
Yes, yeah.
So in terms of the UNHCR call to evacuate, what is the UNHCR role in terms of saying where they get evacuated to, if you see what I mean? So, you know, there's this deal with the US, but it's not working. New Zealand has offered. UNHCR says they all need to be evacuated.
But they have been, they're refugees in Nauru. That's where their refugee status has been determined, and it's under a regional arrangement with Australia. So it's Australia and Nauru's, primarily Australia's, responsibility to get these people somewhere safe. But it's very problematic. They're still digging their heels in and saying they're not coming to Australia. You know, going back to Scott Morrison, the new Prime Minister, there's footage from when he was an immigration minister. They sent videos of him to these camps and saying, "You must understand, you will never live in Australia." That's, that's his line from way back. So, Jacinda said they can come, she'd take 150 a year to New Zealand.
Yeah.
As you say, Australia's still saying that won't happen. I mean, and the other issue is that this isn't Nauru's biggest business. You know, Nauru's a very small country. It has a population of 11,000.
Yeah.
Of which 800 are refugees and asylum seekers, and they get $400,000 a year per refugee from Australia to have them there.
Wow.
Yeah, so the issue, if you take all those refugees off that island and they lose that income.
Yeah, what happens to their economy?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess that sort of leads to the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is that the Nauru government doesn't really appear to agree that there's even a crisis. And I guess I was sort of reflecting on what we talked about before about the difficulty of media access, and yet we still know all this horrific stuff. So imagine what we would know, what the nuances and details are that aren't getting out of the camps as well. But Nauru has said Medicine Sans Frontières must realise that no longer will our country accept the concocted lies told about us purely to advance political agendas. You've talked about the 400,000 per refugee that Nauru is getting. Do you think that's the main motivation for their government? The money?
Yes. I think this is such a big part of their economy that they cannot afford to lose this. They have, they've done this arrangement with Australia. It provides them a significant long-term financial revenue stream. It has provided them a new hospital. It's provided them a lot of other infrastructure. They, I think, literally cannot afford to lose this. I mean, they're a poor island nation. They have environmental issues. They have huge challenges of their own. I think, Australia is very much the architect of this, but that have created an environment where they are entirely dependent on this business.
And so I guess that brings me back a little bit to the regional, to the Pacific Island Forum and the regional development responsibilities that particularly Australia and New Zealand have, because, we are the, the representatives of the colonial powers. In some cases, Australia and New Zealand directly have had colonial relationships with a lot of Pacific Islands. And now we have a responsibility in terms of regional development. I'm thinking about, all the phosphate mining on Nauru, which, as you say, has created a lot of environmental issues for them. And, and also as we think about climate change and the fact that there may be refugees coming from the Pacific Islands. I don't know if that's an issue on Nauru in particular. As the sea level rises, as there's less and less fresh water available. And so thinking about the Pacific Island Forum and I guess the lost opportunity there around regional development.
Yeah, I think it's a shame, because I think all of these issues, whether it's some of the economic and environmental issues on Nauru and how those have been perpetuated by these camps, or whether it's just the solution to how we cope with refugees and asylum seekers in the region, I think you're right. These things need to be dealt with on a regional level.
So, what did Nauru do for money before they had refugees?
They relied on aid.
Aid, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And New Zealand used to give them, we used to give them aid. We pulled a lot of our aid because of concerns about corruption.
Right, okay. Right, okay. So there's no easy answers here.
No.
Sorry about that. So, thinking though about, you know, leaving with a bit of hope. People who are listening, what can they do to help? What can we do as a community, but also as individuals? I mean, it's not like you know, we can boycott some product that comes from Nauru, because you know the main product seems to be the detaining of refugees and asylum seekers. Mm. What can we do to put pressure on to make change?
I think we just need to keep this in people's minds. We need to be talking about this. We need to make sure people know how serious this is, how bad the situation is for these refugees and asylum seekers. And as New Zealanders, you know, to be very clear to our government that this is an issue we vote on, and that we want them to be seen to do the right thing, to keep that pressure on, to keep that offer out there, to push it harder if we can. That's difficult. And to be part of regional solutions to deal with some of these issues.
So I saw someone on Twitter, I think they were joking, suggested...
I'm never sure on Twitter.
No, it can be hard to tell, even with emojis. Suggesting, you know, we should get our Navy and our Air Force and go over there and kidnap these people effectively and set them free in New Zealand.
As in
the New Zealand Armed Forces. But it just seems to me that firstly, I don't think we necessarily have the capacity to do that, but, you know, that's effectively an invasion of a foreign nation.
It is, and also I think Australia has been pretty clear what that would do to our relationship with Australia, and we need to be realistic about how important that relationship is to this country. Our government is not going to do something that is going to seriously damage its relationship with our closest neighbour and biggest partner.
Yeah. All right, that wasn't the hopeful end I was hoping for, so it's okay. We've got a few more minutes to find some more hope. So are there any charities working who, I mean, particularly now that Doctors Without Borders has been evicted, mm. are there any charities that people can support who are working directly with or supporting lobbying efforts or anything like that?
I think at the moment the biggest thing that, in terms of that kind of help that can be done, is to be supporting the organisations who are providing these people with legal support and yep. are ensuring, you know, and are supporting and acting for the doctors and healthcare providers and the individuals on those islands to get them care. I mean, interesting enough, in the last few months, there has been a bit of an exodus. There's been quite a lot of people transferred off, particularly Nauru and particularly children, to Australia for medical treatment. They were all in, you know, very serious need of that treatment, but often that is requiring legal action, or at least the threat of legal action. There's organisations like the National Justice Project, which are a pro bono human rights law firm, and they act for a lot of those groups.
Yeah.
Also, the Asylum Seekers Resource Centre, which is Melbourne-based, National Justice Project, Chester, Sydney. Those are both groups that are doing a lot of that legal and advocacy work and always need donations. If people want to send things to help refugees and asylum seekers on Nauru, we do a bit of that through Mums for Refugees.
Yep.
And there's a group called We Care Nauru, which is based out of Australia, which do that as well. I mean, it's everything from we send... some food, we send kids clothes and toys, but also we send things like incontinence pads, because
yep.
those are not provided to women on Nauru who might have those issues. So and vitamins and some of that sort of stuff. So
I'll put links up to all of those on the Facebook page, folks. So that's Red Alert Radio AKL, if you put that in your Facebook search box. But that was the National Justice Project based in Sydney.
Yeah, Asylum Seekers Resource Centre is in Melbourne.
Yep. And Mums for Refugees.
Mums for Refugees in Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah. So what keeps you going with this? Because it sounds a bit depressing.
It's hard, but, you know, I have been doing this for a number of years. I know a lot of these people now. And once you know what's going on, I'm the kind of person who would rather try and do something about it than do nothing. You've just got to keep trying. And I do think that eventually something will have to change. And in the meantime, we just have to do what we can to support these people, to get them healthcare, and to,
do the best we can.
Yeah, do the best we can, I suppose. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Olivia. Thanks for listening, folks. Don't forget, we're on Facebook, Red Alert Radio AKL. And did you know Planet FM has a great, funny Twitter feed now as well? Thanks very much, folks. See you next month.